Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs podcast. And this week we are checking in with Joshua Drake of Zimperium with exploitation of stage fright via Josh's sweet, sweet exploits. You'd think the mother of all worms is coming to an Android handset near you soon. Well, probably not. Later versions of Android are tricky to exploit, and the diversity of hardware in earlier versions means coming up with one exploit to rule them all isn't entirely feasible. Well, at least it's not easy. We'll drill down into the details of all of that with Josh Drake in this week's feature interview. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, and Tenable's very own Jack Daniel will be along in this week's sponsor interview to add a little bit of context to recent car hacking news. Jack was a mechanic in a previous life, and I myself worked for Bosch as an engineer designing automotive electronics in the 90s, well, 99-2000. So we put our old man pants on and talk about how we arrived in a world in 2015 where 1.4 million Chrysler owners are patching their vehicles against security flaws using a mailed-out USB stick. All of that is coming up later, but before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, we've seen all sorts of things get hacked over the last few years. You know, Barnaby Jack was hacking the old ATMs. More recently, we've seen aeroplanes apparently getting hacked and cars getting hacked. But now we've got a little bit of a worry on our hands with some sniper rifles getting hacked. What?
So apparently you can buy a sniper rifle with a Linux box strapped to it, and that Linux box has Wi-Fi. And surprising no one, when you put a computer on something, then all of a sudden something hacking becomes a thing. Indeed, yes, sniper rifle hacking is in fact a thing. A couple of people, husband and wife.
Hang on. You're just going to have to get to the bit. You sort of jumped ahead there. They attach a Linux box to a sniper rifle. You know, you can't just say that and then not mention why. All right? Because at this point, I'm kind of wondering, why is there a Unix, like, so you can like play Tetris in between target acquisition? Like, what's a Linux box doing attached to a rifle?
The Linux box attached to the sniper rifle is actually in the sight. And then the idea is that you look down the sight, you designate the target by pressing a button on the rifle. It figures out where you are pointing when you designated the target. And then you hold the trigger down. And at some point after that, when you're pointing in exactly the right place, having dialed in, you know, the wind and the weight of your ammunition, all that kind of thing, it will fire for you.
That is not terrifying at all.
Well, I guess it's good for marksmanship. I guess the idea is that, you know, even a dumbass can actually hit the target, which, you know, perhaps
that's not terrifying at all.
But no, this husband and wife team have hacked the Linux box in the scope of this rifle via the Wi-Fi. Got fun exec on it, and then can by twiddling the parameters that the rifle uses to figure out when to fire, make it shoot different things. And the demo video that Wyatt are running actually has them shooting, like designating, the middle of a paper target, and then having the gun shoot the person standing next to the target, which is obviously not a paper target for the purpose of demonstration, actually shoot someone. But yes, like that's, as demos go, it's pretty good. I mean, obviously it's, you know, there's a few of us in the industry who will say, well, that's just junk hacking. No, you put a Linux box onto anything, and then you can hack it, of course. But yeah, having it actually shoot the gun for you,
yeah,
like that's the payload of your exploit. That's a little bit more than just straight up code exec.
Did you see? Did you happen to see that video getting around on YouTube of some guy who strapped a Glock to a drone and was like flying it around and like shooting things with it? That's like between that and this, you know, it's all getting a little bit Skynet for my liking.
Yeah, it certainly is, and you would really hope that if you were in the business of, for example, strapping a Linux box to a sniper rifle, that you might do, you know, some testing.
Authentication?
Auth, for example, would be nice. That kind of thing. But no, and unfortunately, the company that makes this, it's called Tracking Point. The company that makes this apparently has been through a bunch of restructuring lately, laid off a bunch of people. And so they're not actually disclosing the bugs because they're afraid that the company is probably just going to go into receivership and not actually fix them.
The Killing Machine Company might go into receivership? Oh, no.
But yeah, so that might be a bad thing for the people who bought these many $1,000 rifles that are then just going to go pew-pew by themselves. Well, they don't quite go pew-pew by themselves, but, you know, within small values of by themselves. apparently, they can't actually actuate the trigger without the mechanical trigger. Like, the actual firing pin doesn't actuate without the main trigger actually being held down, and that does appear to be a hardware thing, like not a software thing.
Yeah, but yeah.
Pretty much everything other than that.
But still, you know, you don't want your rifle getting hacked and then you're like, boom, sorry, Gus, fuck, mate, are you okay? You know, like, that's not ideal. In other junk hacking that kind of has impact news, Brinks make these, you know, and I guess this goes beyond junk hacking for me, because the whole purpose of this device is to keep stuff secure, right? So they've whacked a computer on a safe, and it's a smart safe. And yeah, you see that little USB port on the side? That's a really easy way to unlock it. This is pretty bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, this company, Brinks, they've been making safes since like the 1800s, right? I mean, this is a company that is core business of security. You'd think they would understand that, you know, the security of their products maybe is paramount, core business, that kind of thing. But no, you strap a WinXP embedded box to your safe, and all of a sudden it's not a safe anymore. It's a WinXP box with a bunch of money inside it. And yes, surprising no one, of course, WinXP box for USB port, you can just pop it. And then you can have it falsify its logs, which it stores in the clear, or make it open up and spew out its money, all that kind of thing. Basically, situation normal in the I strapped an XP box to an otherwise reasonable piece of hardware department. I guess anyone who listens to this podcast probably doesn't need this advice, but if you're a manufacturer of a thing which is not currently, quote, smart, unquote, don't make it smart. It will be worse. End of advice.
This seems like sound advice. Of course, these safes only hold up to about 240,000. So I don't think they're particularly the high-end products. And, you know, given the threats that these things are likely to come up against, you know, I don't think too many people are going to be popping them with USB exploits. Still mention-worthy, though. But, of course, these are the sort of stories you have in pre-Vegas week, don't you? You know, we've got the sniper rifle story. We've got the safe story. I mean, this is just what it's become these days.
Yes, absolutely. This is the typical black hat, you know, pre-black hat dog and pony show where everyone wheels out their, you know, their showmanship exploits. And, you know, to a certain extent, I guess that's part of the fun of doing it in Vegas. But yeah, it's always like this, isn't it? There's always some kind of, you know, junk hacking, whether it's cars or tanks or guns.
Or air gaps, which is our next story.
Air gaps. Apparently, yes, nice segue.
Segue foo. New way to hop an air gap requiring malware on a cell phone, even a dumb cell phone, which is the interesting component to this. Between an owned computer and a cell phone with the right software on it, you can get a low bit rate connection between them. That's kind of interesting, but it's not something we haven't necessarily seen before.
No, I mean, I suppose the thing that's interesting here is that, you know, they're doing it with, you know, basic boring cell phones. This is these university researchers from Israel have demonstrated, you know, basically cooperative Tempest, where a compromised machine that's behind an air gap modulates signals out via its memory buses, and then a cooperating radio receiver, in this case a repurposed 2G cell phone with modified baseband, receives those signals and reconstitutes a bitstream, which is a pretty sweet, you know, it's a pretty sweet demo. But it's, you know, the headline for this, of course, is researchers hack air gapped computer, and it's like, getting data out of a thing you've already hacked is not the same as hacking it. Like, that's exfil. That's what you do after you've hacked it.
You didn't hack, bro. You didn't hack it. You installed some software on it, okay?
Well, no, exactly right. It's just a misleading headline. And, you know, it's from Kim Zeta, who, you know, does kind of know the difference between exfil and hacking. So, you know, pre-Vegas clickbait,
yeah,
kind of a little bit. Well, even though it's really cool research.
I'll tell you something some people don't actually know, which is journalists don't tend to write their own headlines. So there is that. Apparently the US Census Bureau in the United States got knocked over by, you know, Anonymous, which is kind of funny given that the Census Bureau tends to release most of its information. I mean, what did we learn from these stolen databases? I'm guessing not much.
Yeah, so I mean, the headline, of course, coming very soon after the OPM breach is that the US Census Bureau gets breached. But in actual fact, it's not the interesting bits, which would be, you know, de-anonymized census data or raw census data that hasn't been through whatever processes they do before they release the actual data. Instead, it's actual, like, internal staff information, so usernames, email addresses, phone numbers.
I'm sure it's all very riveting stuff, mate. I can't wait to read the US Census Bureau's internal email. I mean, cancel all my appointments. That's what I'm doing all weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, on the scale of the breaches that we've seen recently, it's, you know, relatively small chump change kind of stuff.
Yeah, not so.
But still embarrassing, obviously, for the US government.
Yeah, look, it would be. I can't imagine they would actually collect. I mean, census forms, you don't really put your name on them, do you? So I can't imagine there would be too much risk to privacy, but I'm not, you know, too familiar with the US Census. But anyway, the NSA has come up with a bit of an interesting conundrum. They have agreed to November 29 to absolutely cut off further collection of telephone records under the Section 215 of the Patriot Act. But they're saying they can't delete the information they've collected to date until the lawsuits go away, because there might be, you know, they might have to basically look into that data as part of the legal discovery in these lawsuits, which is, yeah, it is a bit of an interesting conundrum, isn't it?
Well, it is. And it's one of those kind of illogical situations we get into with, you know, the way these laws interact with each other. But yeah, it, you know, the cynic in you, of course, says, well, you know, any excuse to not have to RM the data. But no, I mean, I guess, right, if it's the subject of a lawsuit, they can't delete it, which is, you know, I don't know. It's sort of the funny coda at the end of this particular bit of the story that's the, you know, what it's kind of come to. But yeah, I don't know. I
mean, well, the only reason we know about that program, of course, is because of Edward Snowden. A petition went to the White House asking for him to be pardoned. The White House has come back and said, nope.
Yeah,
which isn't too surprising, but they've put forward a solid case of their point of view, really.
Yes, well, they've come back and said, you know, essentially, if he, you know, wants to be a responsible civil disobedient, then he should do what other people do, which is you do your civil disobedience and then you hang about and accept the consequences, you know, viz. Be prosecuted under, you know, espionage law and sent into jail for the rest of your life.
And that's what he should do if he was a good American, you know.
But yes, because he's not done that, then, and he's gone, you know, hang out with Putin and drink vodka and eat caviar, that you know, he is not going to get pardoned.
Now, a bit of research that tends to pop up every now and then is the fact that you can be profiled by the way you type. Like, it's reasonably easy to identify someone, I guess, from a fairly narrow set based on the way that they type. So these guys have done some more research on that and released a Chrome extension that sort of obfuscates the way you type. Is this kind of seems like novel research, but I can't really imagine that the way that we type our hand, you know, in Morse terms, if you like, really is an anonymity problem just yet.
Yeah, it's one of those things that doesn't quite seem to be here yet, although, I mean, the technology does get used. I mean, this kind of, you know, fingerprinty stuff. You know, we're seeing it in fraud detection. We're seeing it in some commercial systems already, although usually it's one part of a larger set of metrics, you know, in terms of, you know, your browser fingerprint, where you're coming from and all that kind of thing. And this is one of those factors that they use to decide upon it. But, you know, it is a thing that I guess will become, you know, become more prevalent. I mean, the demos of, you know, being profiled as you type into a web browser, you know, via Tor and then via not Tor, and being able to tell that you're the same person by the fingerprint. I mean, that's, you know, quite a compelling demo, even if it's not really a thing that is
being used yet. So you would say that it is quite, it has potential to be an anonymity risk, would you?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, they seem to be making pretty convincing arguments that it will be at some point. On the other hand, the you know, the general category of problem that you're solving here, which is, you know, biometric characteristics that once they are lost, you can't change, that's almost a bigger problem than its uses for anonymity bypass.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that you can't change your fingerprint or your iris or whatever other biometric, you know, you can't change how you type necessarily. And if that data gets stolen, then you're kind of screwed. So, I mean, preventing people from using these biometrics in the first place by just, you know, destroying them at source. In this case, we know with a browser plugin that caches your keystrokes and then delivers them at a predictable rate, rather than in the way that you naturally type them, and you don't notice it. Let's just kill that stuff right now and not have to worry about the next big breach where all of our biometrics get stolen, you know?
I mean, you know, this seems like something you could pretty easily build into a keyboard driver.
Well, exactly. It's quite a simple, you know, conceptually simple thing to do, you know, to confound this particular metric. So, yeah, I mean, why not? I've had the hardware do it even.
Yeah, exactly. Now, speaking of anonymity, a bunch of researchers claim they've developed a new, better, faster Tor, to which I'm like, I'm a little bit wary when people say stuff like that.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, the users of Tor, Tor has lasted pretty well. I mean, the fact that it has made it this far does suggest that it's kind of converged on a relatively robust solution. And anyone who's coming along suggesting a replacement obviously has to be able to demonstrate that theirs works at least as well as Tor. I mean, the Tor network is slow, and that is inconvenient, but
not always, you know, man. I mean, it's not as bad as a lot of people think. Like, honestly,
no,
it's not.
It is much more usable than you expect.
Yeah, it is.
You know, that would be my preference, I think, is to iterate on, you know, the thing we've got that already works rather than go off and deploy something new. I mean, even though the name is Hornet, which is pretty sweet, I guess.
But if you put the emphasis on the wrong syllable, you wind up with...
Then, unfortunately, there's a slight homonym problem of it being hornet, yes.
Yes, yes, that could be a bit of a marketing faux pas. there we go. Ours is carrying a pretty funny story about Hackers List, which, of course, this was the, you know, find professional hackers to do totally legitimate things for you. And it's, you know, it's like one of those places where you post a job and then there's, you know, it's like a Dutch auction sort of thing. Hackers, quote unquote, will go and say, yeah, I can do this for X amount of dollars. But of course, like all of the jobs that get posted are like, I need to hack into my husband's WhatsApp because I'm pretty sure he's cheating on me. I mean, you know, Blind Freddy could have seen that coming, as we say.
Yeah, it's really not a surprise to anyone. And the company that runs this is attempting to kind of, you know, claim it's a legitimate marketplace and filter the jobs that are posted with some kind of, you know, kind of community moderation thing. But, you know, essentially running Craigslist for hacking services is just never going to go well.
No, it's not.
I don't
not.
Think anyone is surprised that it's filled with rubbish, low-value jobs being bid on by a number of, you know, presumably fairly rubbish, low-value hackers.
And this is why Bugcrowd exists. And this is why HackerOne exists. And,
exactly,
you know,
like, yeah.
It's all about the engagement model, people. Pakistan has banned Blackberries. You know, we saw India threaten to do this a while ago and eventually they backed down. But yeah, it looks like they banned Blackberries, which is kind of curious considering, like, who really uses Blackberries anymore? I would have thought, you know, basic, you know, iOS and Android apps like Wickr and Signal and things like that, they would have been a bigger problem than Blackberry.
You would certainly think so, eh? But what's interesting here, this is not just like regular BlackBerry. This is specifically the BlackBerry Enterprise stuff that, you know, does end-to-end crypto into the corporate-controlled BlackBerry Enterprise server as opposed to just regular people running BlackBerries, which is an interesting niche, right? I mean, that's the targeting that specific enterprise thing. As opposed to regular people. So that's a twist that I guess we saw in India, right, that they were more concerned about regular BlackBerry use and they managed to convince RIM to put intercept capability in country and then it was fine for the non-enterprise. So, yeah, it's a little bit different than the Indian case. But, yes, you know, clearly the Pakistanis have been trying to build up, you know, they're obviously a bit jelly of the NSA's solution and have been building up, you know, the same sort of capability inside Pakistan. And this is one step, you know, along that path that, I mean, really, as you say, people have got to be using alternative messengers by now anyway, or indeed are sufficiently agile to go and move to other things if they have to.
Yeah,
if you want to do this kind of thing, you have to be agile now, right? I mean, you have to follow where... you know, you have to be one step ahead of this kind of regulation.
Yeah, look, I think, though, what we tend to forget in the West, and, you know, I had a really interesting conversation with Roger Dingledine of Tor about this, you know, a few months ago when I was in Africa. And, you know, you look at China, right? And, okay, they don't like some encrypted service. Say it's iMessage. Boom, just block it, right? People can't use it anymore. So then they'll go to the next thing, WhatsApp. Boom, block that. They have to go to the next thing. Okay, they start using Tor. Right, anything that's throwing traffic that looks like it might be Tor goes on a list. Later, a process comes by, tries to talk Tor to it. If it can talk Tor to it, boom, it gets dropped, right? So these regimes, like these governments, can make it very difficult for you to actually access unapproved encrypted services. So, I mean, you know, it's easy for us to say, oh, well, you just moved to something else. But that's coming from our context where our government doesn't block encryption, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. And I guess we, you know, one of the things that the Tor project has been very good at is attempting to build ways to allow people to get around that kind of thing through, you know, private reasons, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's a, you know, it is a harder problem than I made it out to be. You're right.
It's just funny though, like the extent to which China is having success at blocking Tor is really quite interesting. I mean, there's still people able to get traffic out, but it's a constant battle. One of the only ways you can do it is like do a key distribution, then you turn up to like a Tor relay with that key and then it talks Tor to you. But then you've got that whole, you know, key distribution problem in the first place and it's a big nightmare. So it is, yeah, it's pretty fraught, this stuff. But anyway, look, another one from ours that went around, I saw this doing the rounds on Facebook, is someone's gone and compared what security experts do for their online safety versus what people who are not experts in computer security who still care about it do. And the findings are really interesting.
Yeah, this was some research that came out of Google that they presented at Usenix. And it's a really interesting list. The number one thing that non-security people, non-expert people do who care about security is run antivirus. And of course, you know, that's not even on the list of things that people who are security practitioners do. So that's, you know, that's certainly a big misconception that, you know, given the badness of antivirus products is bad. But yeah, it's an interesting list. You know, obviously software updates, unique passwords, two-factor auth are on the list of things that we would recommend. But what regular people do is use strong passwords and change them often, as opposed to two-factor and using, you know, a password.
Well, that's our fault. That used to be the advice. You know what I mean? Change your passwords. I mean, I've never really seen the point in that, you know, if you're using unique passwords. So, yeah, it's a funny one, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And it is a result of our advice, you know, kind of trickling down very slowly into the real world and being, you know, 10 years out of date, 15 years out of date.
Yeah, that's right. And they only visit the websites they know, which I think is kind of funny, especially in the age of malvertising. Yahoo has just come out and announced, done an announcement around their bug bounty program. Now, you know, just a smidge over 2 years ago, we were laughing at them because some guy found all these awful bugs and he got $5 and a sun hat sort of thing, or a pair of Yahoo socks. Well, over the last 2 years, they've paid out $1 million in bug bounties, which is a hell of a turnaround.
Yeah, that certainly is a big change. I mean, the number of they've got some good stats on, like, the breakdown of the number of researchers versus the distribution of bugs that are being, you know, of quality bugs that are reported by those researchers. You know, something like 6% of the researchers submit half the bugs that are actually real bugs. And, you know, those people presumably are making a, you know, good change out of that that $1 million. But no, it's a demonstration of bug bounty programs working, especially when you give away more than just T-shirts.
Indeed. Meanwhile, speaking of malvertising, around 10 million, up to 10 million users may have actually been hosed in a recent malvertising campaign. Just used the Angler exploit kit and just boom, got it out there. They were targeting readers of the Japanese Huffington Post, some manga site, and an Indonesian newspaper, and a bunch of others. But yeah, it looks like they would have reached an awful lot of people.
Yeah, it does sound like this month has been a pretty rough in the malvertising department. I mean, people compromising ad networks and dropping exploit kits. You know, Angler is the one that we are primarily seeing. Of course, the hacking team bugs got weaponized and used pretty quickly. I'm not sure if Angler is deploying those. I think I read somewhere that it was, but that would really, you know, certainly account for you know, a fairly large amount of people getting owned. But then, of course, the next question is, once you've been owned, you know, once you've got 10 million people in your botnet, what are you going to do with it? And that's where things start to get really bad for the users. I mean, you know, uptick in crypto lockers and ad fraud and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. And yeah, that advice about only visiting the websites you know, probably doesn't help in this case.
Not particularly useful.
Also, some click fraud stuff going on around there. Also, there's some pretty heavy click fraud stuff happening out there on the intertubes. If that is of interest to you, go check it out in this week's show notes. We've got an interesting piece here about the group that hacked Anthem Healthcare. Now, this was a very big deal breach, but apparently they were sharing some of their goodies, some of their zero days with some other attackers, which is interesting.
Yeah, so this is research that's come out of Symantec comparing some of the toolchain and exploits being used by these you know, distinct groups and seeing some similarity, which is quite interesting. I mean, all the signs, I guess, in this case do point back to China, but their analysis of the Anthem breach is quite interesting in suggesting that it was done by the group that was hitting aerospace and, you know, electronics and other, you know, kind of high energy industry stuff a couple of years ago, and that they would hit. The suggestion is that they hit Anthem, you know, as a sort of a second order target to get more information about people they're going to go and hit in the industry sectors that really are their targets, which, you know, this being, and I get the point that Symantec makes, which I think is quite good, is that this really is, you know, work a day, you know, every day in the office for these groups. And the Anthem breach to us really did look like, you know, quite an unusual and high profile big target, you know, targeting healthcare insurance. When in fact, actually, it's just every day at the office, you know, and their collateral damage in going after the real, you know, the real target, energy sector, aerospace sector, which should be pretty sobering, I guess, for anyone who is in, you know, secondary service industries like that.
Yeah, well, secondary targeting's been an issue on the radar for quite a while, and it's just interesting to see those sort of early trends become just the way it's done. Moving on to some bugs now. Apple has patched the so-called remote invoice vulnerability in the iTunes App Store. What's this one about? Looks pretty bad.
It's essentially straight-up cross-site scripting using the name of your Apple device into the invoice that's then generated. So you can cause script execution in the context of the person receiving the bill, but that also affects people who have App Store vendor accounts, so they get an invoice saying, you know, we sold this product to so-and-so user, and it has the name of the device in it, and it wasn't correctly escaped. So yes, script execution, you know, plausibly into account compromise for vendors on iTunes or maybe users. Interesting bug, actually.
More bugs in QEMU.
Yeah, another guest to host. Of course, you know, it's exactly the same sort of same place that we've seen all of the other bugs in QEMU over the last, you know, couple of years for guest to host escape. This one's in the emulated virtual CD-ROM driver. You know, root cause here, of course, is that all of that QEMU emulation code was written by uni students, was never intended to be, you know, security critical, and now it's, you know, shared off into a number of the virtualization products.
Like Xen, which is affected in this case, yeah.
The main one that's affected. And some versions, early versions, I think, of the straight-up QEMU package as well. But yes, you're going to want to patch that if you run large-scale Xen installations or certain you know, other QEMU installations. Check with your vendor. But yes, it's a pretty sweet bug.
It's a proper hypervisor bypass, really.
Proper hypervisor guest to host, yes, which, I mean, you know, those are damn good bugs.
Now, ThreatPost is carrying this story. PHP file manager riddled with vulnerabilities, including backdoor. And they have managed to – they've excelled themselves with the clip art this week, Adam.
They have. It's one of the real joys of the news brief every week for Risky Business is looking at what ThreatPost have done with the story, you know, the inspiration that comes
what the art department has done, you mean?
in this case, we have a screenshot of the PHP file manager with a nice gray, rather low-res door. Paste it over the top of it with the opacity set just so.
Just so. It's right, isn't it? It's beautiful. Indeed. It's a work of art.
Who would have thought commercial unsupported PHP file manager has horrible bugs in it?
I know I'm shocked. I should have brought this to the front of the bulletin. But yeah, if you are using this horrible, horrible shit where you can go patch it, but really there is no hope for you if this is something you were doing. Just so we mention it for the clip art. there's another Android bug in addition to JDux bugs, which we're chatting about in this week's feature interview. There's another pretty nasty DOS condition in Android phones.
Yeah, this is essentially if you can write down a media file to the phone of a particular format, then the indexer that goes through and indexes all the files on the phone will choke on this particular Matroska video file and then just hard lock. And if you do this, you know, with an app or something that starts on boot, then yeah, essentially you brick the phone, which is pretty sweet. Like, that's a nice thing to drop with your Android exploit, I guess, if you'd like to take
ruin someone's day.
And, well, I think that would make some of our days quite enjoyable, those of us who don't run Android phones and would quite like to see it fixed.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you'll hear in this week's feature, there was a really funny time when JDuck actually whipped up a PNG exploit, like just a proof of concept, real ghetto, and he tweeted a link to it, but he didn't realize that because it was PNG, the Twitter clients would all auto-render it. And it actually wound up with, like, a lot of people who followed him on Twitter couldn't boot their boxes afterwards. So
what a jerk.
What a jerk. I thought that was great. WordPress, surprise, surprise, has patched a critical cross-site scripting vulnerability in all builds, which is nice and fun for WordPress users. Funnily enough, there was a great Photoshop job going around about the 2015 Jeep WordPress edition. I don't know if you saw that. That was pretty good. Valve has patched a bug that would have allowed people to take over Steam accounts.
That was such a comedy bug. Essentially, they broke when you reset your password on Steam, it sends you a code in the email. It turned out they broke it. Such that if you just didn't enter the code on the form, it would let you through anyway. Oh. So yeah, pretty bad. They fixed it quite quickly, but yeah, what a ridiculous.
That's
bug.
What you would call a bit of a logic problem. Right. A little bit. Also, there's a remotely exploitable DOS in Bind, which is it's a pretty bad one, man. I mean, this is the sort of bug that you see. And, you know, DOS bugs in Bind are a big deal because if they're bad enough, you know, it wouldn't take much of a botnet to basically take down, you know, a lot of the internet. So you just – every time I see one of these, I just go a little bit, eesh.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Bind bugs have been a, you know, real workaday category of bugs, you know, forever. As long as I've been in the security industry, they've been Bind bugs. Obviously, we haven't seen CodeExec in a while, but DOS in this kind of infrastructure is still a really big deal. And this one is unusual in that it affects a really wide range of Bind versions and is actually in an area where we've seen, it must be half a dozen bugs like this in the Tiki. Handling of Tiki queries, which, you know, you would hope that piece of code had been well looked over by now, but, you know, I guess whoever had a look at it found yet another bug and ruined it once again. So, yes, everyone patch their binds.
Indeed. Okay, Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him. Now, before we move on, I should announce that Thomas Weilbach won the Black Hat Pass that Thinkst were offering to a lucky listener. In answer to the question, what is the funniest thing that we've learned from the Hacking Team breach? The winning answer was, it turns out a domain controller is a great place to manage your domain and download torrents. And the tweet came complete with a screen cap that appears to show that indeed Hacking Team were downloading pirated movies right onto their domain controller. Now, honestly, I'm not 100% sure that that screen cap is legit, but who cares? It made us laugh. And sadly, it is plausible. So congratulations, Thomas, and have fun in Vegas. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now. The bugs in Android's Stage Fright, found by Joshua Drake of Zimperium, are a pretty big deal, and the tech media certainly agrees. But it is my feeling they might be hyping them up a little bit. 950 million devices can be hijacked by malicious messages, screams the headline from Ars. Now, it is bad. The exploit works by triggering a bug in a content previewer, so you can load it up into an MMS message and own the handset before it can even notify the user that it's received a message. All you need is the victim's phone number and the model and OS version. But the vast majority of Android handsets out there are actually pretty tricky to exploit. ASLR in versions higher than 4.1, which is most of them, means you'd really have to flood your victim with hundreds of messages if you wanted to have a reasonable chance at owning them. And chances are they're probably going to notice that. But Joshua was kind enough to join me for this interview via Skype, where we talk about these bugs, the Android ecosystem more broadly, and how iOS stacks up against it. Here's what he had to say.
So in April, I reported a bundle of patches to Google. I just sent them straight up patches from the work I had been doing. So my approach was kind of looking for vulnerabilities, and after every time I found one, I would just fix it.
Like, yeah, well, that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, so I had my own code base, and I was going through the code, and every time I confirmed that an issue was an issue, I would just patch it, and that way I didn't have to worry about finding it again.
Yeah. Yep, so you patch it in your own code, and then you just share that with them.
Well, yep, exactly. So I took the patches, and I rebased them up against the Android open source master, because that's what they want you to report it in. Sent them over to them, and within 24 hours, they accepted the patches into AOSP. And by into AOSP, I mean into what will eventually become AOSP, because their process is such that they have a private tree that will eventually get pushed to the public tree.
So why don't you walk us through the showstopper here, a Stage Fright. Why don't you walk us through this one? What I mean, it seems like a big deal, right? By the looks of things, it's to do with previewing multimedia content in MMS messages. So you fire off a text to someone, boom, you've owned their phone, right?
Yes. So when looking into exactly how these vulnerabilities are exposed, I found there were multiple attack vectors, you know, anywhere from the typical sort of downloaded in the browser to silly stuff like you have a malicious file on an SD card and you stick it into somebody's device, something like that. And there's others as well that kind of vary.
So it's like a preview function in the OS, right? Which will, you know, index. So this reminds me a little bit of a bug that was in OS 10 years ago, where if you dropped a certain file type onto the disk, when the Spotlight indexer came through to like index it for the, you know, Spotlight search function on OS 10 systems, it would actually hose the box that way. So it seems like, yeah, one of those background processes comes into contact with a new file, goes to index it or whatever, and then boom, right?
Yes, it's very similar to that. And I will tell you right now, though, that I'm pretty sure that on OS X Spotlight, still doing that.
What, auto-indexing or getting owned by
auto-indexing?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it does. It does. I mean, most OSs do, right?
There are probably bugs like that that still exist, but obviously that's not the focus of my research recently. So yes, it's a preview functionality. It's one of those types of behaviors that really just makes me shiver, because it's very sort of promiscuous and kind of viral, right? If you think back to the old days of viruses where there were an awful lot of file infector type things where you would open a document and it would exploit a vulnerability or whatever in the program that opens it, and it, as part of its payload, it would look for all the documents of that type and infect them, right? So it has that kind of feel to it. I know back in 2006, there was that WMF exploit, It has that sort of feeling where, you know, all you have to do is preview it. You know, if it's on your desktop, it'll preview like that kind of feeling. Those kind of issues make me shudder a little bit.
Now, what I find interesting about this is there's not too much clarity about which versions are meaningfully impacted. So Android introduced ASLR in version 4.2, is that right?
In 4.1.
In 4.1, right. So does it affect, you know, 4.1 and up? Because that makes up the vast majority of, you know, Android devices out there. Something like 10, 12% are pre-4.1.
Yeah, I think it's around 10, 12%. I think that's right. So there was some ASLR before 4.1 as well, but 4.1 is when they finally got kind of full ASLR.
Mm. So, I mean, we're seeing the headlines, which is, you know, 950 million devices affected.
Yes.
But what's the ease of exploitation like on 4.1 and up?
Okay, that's a great question. So exploitation on 4.1 and up in the scenario we described to media is still theoretically 100% possible.
Okay, but would you need to like brute force an offset or something like that?
Yeah, you'd pretty much have to brute force it, or you'd have to find some research, which we have not found any yet, that allows you to disclose memory from the vulnerable service or to somehow otherwise work around ASLR. So right now I have a proof of concept exploit that I've been working on, and it works pretty well on pre-4.1 devices.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, hey, why don't I give it a test on 4.4.4, which is, you know, the last release prior to Lollipop being out. And also it's about 40% of the ecosystem uses a 4.4 release.
Mm.
So I gave it a shot, and my exploit didn't fully work because of ASLR pretty much.
Mm.
But the thing was, it worked without any modification up to the point where ASLR would become an issue. So basically, when you have like this kind of memory corruption exploit and you've got non-executable memory that you have to deal with, you have to bypass that using ROP usually. And so ASLR doesn't really become an issue until you hit ROP. And so what happened was, when I tested it, I had full control already over all the registers, including the program counter, the stack pointer, everything I needed to go to the next stage if I just knew where anything was.
Yeah, you just need to know where to point them, right?
Right, and it's completely theoretically possible to just keep guessing and sending MMSs each guess, or even not just keep guessing, but just pick a good number that's statistically good and just keep trying until it works. And there's the only thing a user could do to stop you is like turn off the radio, or, you know, they could enact a mitigation where the auto retrieve is turned off. So there are some things they could do to prevent it, but the default settings on these devices is such that, you know, it would allow you to do this attack brute force. Say, you know, somebody goes to bed at 11 p.m., you wait till 12 and you just start hammering them.
Yeah, but I mean, unless you actually successfully execute and own that device, right, if the vibrating or ding-dinging doesn't wake them up, right, it's going to take you hundreds of messages to be able to own them. And, you know, like it's sort of being reported as like 950 million devices can be owned, you know, with a single text message. And, you know, of those, I'm
well,
going somewhere with this.
Sensationalist headline.
Yeah, I'm going somewhere with this, Josh, right? Which is that, like, those 10, 12% of devices that are straight up ownable, surely there's going to be enough diversity within that 10 or 12%, because the ones that are the really early OSs, they're going to be the more obscure handsets. So that particular end of the Android ecosystem, you're going to have like many different types of handsets making that up, and your memory addresses for each exploit for those is going to be different. So the idea that you could turn this into a worm that would even hose the most vulnerable of the Android devices, that's going to be very hard because it's a fragmented ecosystem.
I think to some degree that's true. The diversity in the ecosystem in general is definitely a barrier for research in all ways, right? Is finding bugs, writing exploits, all of that stuff. That said, you can do things like find somebody's user agent, for example, through the browser, which will tell you exactly what device and what version they're using. It's very, very, very forthcoming about that device. And with that information, you can use publicly available firmwares to then attack the device as if there was no issue. I think the diversity definitely causes a bit of an issue, but I don't think it's impossible to work around it. Certainly a worm would be difficult to execute in that degree, in that form. But if you're going to write a worm for something like this, I don't really want to say this because like I don't want to help people to write worm. But like if you're going to do it, you're going to figure out what device is the one that's so popular and you're going to go after that.
Yeah, you are. And I mean, even if you did it by brute forcing addresses on 4.4, you know, you'd probably be able to get it going enough so that it would self-sustain, right? Just by brute forcing everyone's phones and clogging up the cell tubes. But I guess this is a really interesting bug in a lot of ways, right? Because it is very pervasive and it does affect a lot of different versions, a lot of different handsets. But it seems like the thing that makes Android very difficult to patch, which is the diversity of the ecosystem, is also the thing that makes it difficult to exploit en masse. So the very thing that makes it quite insecure is also something that mitigates the worst of it. Would you agree with that?
To a degree, I would absolutely agree with that. You know, I've spoke about this publicly before in various conferences and stuff. The diversity definitely presents a challenge to doing research and to developing exploits. But I don't believe that it's one that's I don't think it's one that's impossible to work around. You know, something that Spender likes to point out with kernel vulnerabilities and the sort of futility of kernel ASLR is that the kernel images for Linux machines are, you know, usually built and shipped as a binary. So if that's the case, like KSLR really doesn't help very much. And that's the same with Android firmware. You know, the firmwares are out there, they're downloadable. And they're completely predictable. You can bet nearly like whatever you want, and that firmware is going to match whatever device that you have discerned is running that firmware. Or does that make sense?
Yeah, look, it does. But I'm wondering, like, if you've been able to successfully exploit it on 4.4 or even version 5 plus, like, have you actually got your exploit to trigger against them?
I haven't got a shell from those devices at this point, but it's something I'm working on. There's been a lot of work spent on developing custom tools and things. It turns out in the Android ecosystem and ARM Linux ecosystem, the tool chains are somewhat lacking. And so, you know, some of it has been developing custom tools to figure out how to do this stuff myself. A good example is I had to develop a way to send myself MMS messages and serve myself media without touching carrier networks.
Yeah, so that would have been a fun side project, right?
It's not really a side project because it's necessary to go to the next phase, you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's critical to the
research. So I wish it was a side project, then I could just come back to it later and enjoy it. But it's like, okay, I want to do this, so now, oh man, now I have to do that? Okay, let's do it.
Do you think the fact that your bug, this bug that was exploitable on previous versions but isn't on, you know, current versions and recent versions, do you think this is an indication that the exploit mitigation stuff that Google has put into Android has actually made it a fairly safe platform, or do you still think it's a pretty dangerous platform?
Well, I don't think I would call it a dangerous platform by any means.
Not compared to iOS, because iOS seems to get a lot fewer issues than Android.
Well, it's a lot harder to get into it's a lot harder to get into iOS research as well. I mean, you've got to spend a lot of money on a device, and then you've got to immediately void the warranty. If there's a jailbreak available, you know, so like there's a lot of stuff that you have to do on iOS that makes it sort of adversarial to get into it. And having finally taken a first look at it within the last few months, I can say that even though like it has code signing, which is a really neat feature, I still feel like Android and iOS are about the same. They're similar, the same sort of difficulty, but they're different.
Yeah. Well, and the patching component, right, and the ecosystem component with Android is certainly inferior. You got to give me that, right?
I'll give you that. But at the same time, just because your patching infrastructure is better doesn't mean that you're better overall. I mean, there was a PNG vulnerability discovered by a Russian guy that worked for a short time for the Chrome team afterwards. I found this vulnerability just randomly getting, disclosed, and I was like, that sounds really interesting. Like, PNGs are pretty pervasive. Like, that's supported everywhere, right? So I set upon myself to develop a proof of concept for that vulnerability. It took me about a day or two to get something working. Funny enough, in the process of which I locked my server machine up and had to reboot it by pressing the hard button. But so I get this POC put together. I gzipped it, which took the file from 4 gigabytes. It required a 4 gigabyte file to trigger this vulnerability. So I took it from 4 gigabytes down to 400K or something like that. I put it on my website and I tweeted it, and it crashed everybody. Like everybody, I went to lunch, and when I came back, everybody was like, "Dude, what the hell did you do to my computer?"
Some pretty next level trolling. Was there some image data there of like Rick Astley?
No, there was no image data at all. It just triggered the vulnerability.
Yeah, right.
It's still on my website today if you want to go look at it.
No, that's all right. I got work to do.
Well, you're patched now. And so my point was, I did a consulting gig with Charlie Miller. And while we were on that gig, I said, "Hey, let's look at this PNG on your iPhone and you can pull the crash dump and show me." So we did that. And I already had PC control straight out of the box on his phone. With that, and I never even looked at it, right? Like all I did was create a proof of concept and put it up, and then I didn't change the file at all. I didn't manipulate it. I just said, load this and see what happens.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of shared code for stuff like image parsing, right? Like that stuff dates back a while.
It is, but in this particular case, Android wasn't affected by this vulnerability, and that's because the way they call into the libpng library was different.
So you're saying it's much of a muchness, really, between iOS and Android.
I think it's a pretty even race with, you know, major differences. With Android having the SE Linux in place now and the ability to update policies on the fly, that gives them a pretty powerful platform to work with.
Mm.
Now, the reason why I was telling you that story about this vulnerability, I posted the POC to Twitter. It crashed people, right? And people told me it crashed their iPhones. People told me they saved it on their OSX, the desktop of their OSX machine, and they could no longer boot. But it took Apple almost a year to patch this vulnerability afterwards.
That's not ideal.
Not at all, especially after especially knowing what I knew, which was that file would crash with control of the program counter on an iPhone.
Mm.
Right? And I didn't even mean to do that. That was like the dumbest POC I could put together. I was like, this should crash you. The reason it crashed everybody is because I forgot it was going to inline render the image into their Twitter clients.
Mm.
I just meant to link them to the file, not to crash them like straight up. So
it seems like I reckon Google may have gotten away with, because when Android first came out, like the security was a joke, right? So it looks like they have gotten away with it. I mean, the last thing to clean up would be the third party install shit, which is how everyone on Android seems to get owned. But generally speaking, the ecosystem looks pretty good now.
Well, a lot of the code inside of Android does not look so good, and the Stagefright library is a great example of that.
Mm.
You know, the mitigations and other things that they've invested into Android have helped some, but I don't believe it. Like, for example, in the case of the research that I brought to bear recently, I don't believe that the mitigations are an end-all be-all. I never have, and anybody who has ever written an exploit understands that mitigations are a roadblock.
Mm.
They're not a wall.
Mm.
They're not a cage, right? Like, they're not something you're not getting out of. They're something that you've got to do something magical to get around it. And the magical thing over time turns into not a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It becomes something that the first time it's done, everyone goes, wow. And then after a while, it's just like, okay, we'll use that technique.
Look at Windows, right? They had introduced finally full ASLR, and then for years, and even still, people are finding ways to load some library that doesn't support ASLR.
Mm.
And that's like the most trivial way you could bypass ASLR possible. Who's to say that doesn't exist on Android? I don't think that really does. I think they have some ways to check for that sort of thing. But who's to say there isn't some other similar technique that would work?
Yeah, exactly. And you chain that with the bugs that you've disclosed, and all of a sudden you're looking at a real problem.
Yeah, now you're looking at two MMSs, one that gives you what you need and as far as the way memory is set up, and then the other one that just owns you.
Yeah, well, that, you know, where's that one? Why haven't you found that one?
Well, you know, I only have so much time in every day, just like you. I have two kids, and I've got to make sure they eat and make sure the garbage gets taken out and all that BS. I don't like the human condition that much, but I have to do it.
All right. Well, Joshua Drake, that's all we got time for. Thanks a lot for your time. And, you know, I know you're really busy. Have a great time in Vegas, mate. And I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again soon.
Yes, you will be missed in Vegas, my friend. We all wish you would be there. You're a great guy to hang out with.
Joshua Drake of Zimperium there. Big thanks to him. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jack Daniel of Tenable Network Security. Tenable makes great SIEM gear and vulnerability scanning software like Nessus. You can check them out at tenable.com. Or if you're headed to Vegas, I'm sure they'll be around there. So car hacking. The Jeep thing has been in the news for the last week and a bit, getting heaps of play. And the mainstream media is indeed having a field day. Fox News actually published a story with the headline, "Patch Your Chrysler Before Hackers Kill You," which I thought was a very nice touch, a nice way to frame the nuanced debate around automobile security. Good work, Fox. But as a computing system, automotive is a mess. So how did we get here? Well, I have a little bit of insight into this. I worked for Bosch in a previous life in an engineering team. Circuits I designed wound up in production on Mercedes light trucks and even the Hyundai Tiburon. What a claim to fame. But yeah, that was around 99, 2000. And I was around when this stuff was sort of kicking off meaningfully. Jack Daniel was actually a mechanic who eventually moved into dealer support and then InfoSec. So we got together and looked back at the history of computers in cars. Here's Jack.
Like a lot of people my age that are in this industry, I just sort of stumbled into it. I started out as an auto mechanic, and the path, I'm still not sure how I ended up where I was, but you know, years ago I was an auto mechanic. I was a specialist in Renaults and Jeeps, so I was apparently masochistic enough to make it into InfoSec. But I was in the field as we moved from points to electronic ignitions to, you know, computerized things, early computerized cars. And so it's interesting to watch how far it's gone, and in many ways how far it hasn't advanced. You know, some of the stuff that you see at first, it's like that they couldn't really have made a mistake that fundamental. And then I remember, you know, busting knuckles because they couldn't figure out which way to put a bolt in so you could take a car apart. I'm like, oh yeah, they could be that dumb.
It has been interesting to watch it evolve. You know, one of my close friends is actually a Mercedes mechanic, and he specializes in everything pre-95 because he's like, he calls it the age of the shitter, which is between 95 and 05 when kind of electronics just started coming in and people didn't really know how to design them for serviceability. But you were kind of around for that period, and you even worked supporting dealers, right?
Yeah, so I was supporting, you know, by that point in time, I'd moved from being a mechanic into parts and service management. And then somewhere in there, I became responsible for the computer systems. And eventually I realized all I was doing was computer systems, and I expanded to doing multiple dealers. But that meant I was integrating with the various manufacturers to help the mechanics understand, you know, newfangled computer technology. And, you know, there were things that just drove me nuts. You know, one that used to drive me nuts was Volvo pre-Ford acquisition and to the beginning of that, you know, dating how far back that was. They did things like when they updated computers, you had to be connected to the internet, and they pretty much wiped the engine control module. They flattened it and then downloaded a new package and slammed it on, which meant if you had high latency or lost internet connectivity or anything, step one was to blow the computer image away. And then step two was hope that you could like pull it down.
You know, you mentioned Volvo earlier, and they actually got in a bit of trouble for encrypting diagnostics information through OBD, right? So you would actually have to buy their special machine, and that turned into a big antitrust thing, and it all, you know, all went away. But I mean, has anything changed in the way that cars were patched in the 90s versus now? Because it looks like it's still a very similar procedure, only the end user can do it with a USB instead of the dealer doing it with a very expensive USB.
Yeah, I think that it's become easier for somebody. Obviously, it varies not just by manufacturer, but model within the manufacturer, because there's so many different options. But yes, there are more paths. I remember 10 years ago, the first time I saw them adding Bluetooth adapters to the computers in the shop at a Jeep dealer so that they could talk to the Chrysler and Jeep products via Bluetooth when they came in, rather than having to plug a cable in every time. I just remember like shaking my head thinking this will end badly. But you know, there are more options. But the same problems still exist. If you go back into the 80s, we would have, you know, troubles. This is before CAN bus and the alleged, you know, high speed, low speed bus. There were things where people would come in and put an aftermarket radio in and the car wouldn't run.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a problem that's been around for decades and it still exists. And once we got to CAN bus and the problem, you know, once we got to OBD2 era and the problem still existed, it was like, wait a minute, if the radio can do something, then, you know, we're not filtering signals, we're not doing anything. And even if it's just, you know, it's screwing up, you know, it's creating ground loops or something, you know, it doesn't have a clean ground, it's dumping power back or something, it still should be isolated because that's on the wrong bus. And that's, you know, that's a problem that exists. And I don't know if it, you know, in the case of the headline news now, but, you know, one of the challenges was, you know, they're so cost conscious in the automotive industry that, you know, if it costs an extra, you know, $1.80 or $2.10 to get a processor that can handle signed code to do, you know, the extra math required to do that, then they don't want to do it because they think about, you know, they think about that unit cost. And one of the things that, you know, the auto industry has done forever, and it's, you know, the only way they can be an industry, is they put a dollar value on human life. I mean, that's where they start, right?
You're referring to the Pinto case, right? Which is when Ford figured out that if a Pinto got hit on a certain corner while the blinker was on, there was a chance that it would basically burst into flames. And they worked out that it was cheaper to pay the settlement lawsuits than to actually fix the problem and do the recall. Since then, though, that has been outlawed. That was something that happened in the 70s. Right. And it is a case study that I learned about at university.
Yeah, but there are still issues. Like, I mean, when you look at the one that that resonates in with me living in New England, and there are other places, the reason that Saabs, you know, may they rust in peace, and Volvos are built the way they are on the front, the windshield pillars, the A pillars, is because they are in Scandinavian countries and they have moose or reindeer strikes all the time. Clip them at the legs, a very large animal hits the windshield, comes in with you. People suffer and die. That happens a lot in upper New England, but the American car manufacturers don't lose enough people to that to put the investment into the reinforced A pillars because it's not mandated and it's not something that's tested against. So they put a dollar value on it. And
They do.
It's not a straight up, you know, the Pinto case was just absolutely terrifyingly, horribly, you know, cold-blooded.
Yeah, I mean, what you say about the unit cost is absolutely true. So I spent a year and a half working with Bosch as an engineer designing current sensing circuitry to basically detect blown indicator bulbs, which, given the budget for the entire circuit, was a few cents, less than a few cents, to do this reliably across all of the temperature ranges and the voltage ranges. I mean, they will spend the money on engineering to get me to do something incredibly difficult, which is to profile this very cheap circuit with huge manufacturing variances in all of the components. They would rather pay an engineer to work out how to do that than spend even another 1 cent on the actual production of the unit, which just goes to show you how finely tuned they do it. A Risky Business listener has actually made a very good point on Twitter. I can't remember who it was who wrote this to me, but they pointed out that, you know, a lot of people have been saying, oh, well, most cars aren't really online all the time. You know, it's not really a big deal, this Jeep thing. But they point out that every time you get into a modern car and you Bluetooth connect your mobile phone, guess what? That's connected to the internet. That is a point that I don't think's really been made in this debate.
That is a good point, because what happened in this Jeep case is just an automotive version of what happens in a normal penetration test or, you know, active compromise, right? You find a way in. Maybe you have to load some code on the whatever system you got into. You work that over until it's in your control, and then from there you attack other systems, and which is, you know, standard compromise. It's also effectively what happened with this Jeep. And that entry point is whatever one is available. And yes, if your phone is connected, if people can get to you via your phone, you know, it connects via Bluetooth, like you said, or you hop in, and there are all sorts of paths, and a lot of them are probably safe. Like, you know, anybody that has made the mistake of having a dead battery in their phone when they hop in a rental car and they plug in USB because they see a USB port, and then it starts trying to load software, and you start thinking, huh, if I had said yes, you know, what's the connectivity? And a lot of them, probably there isn't much, but a lot of them, I think there is some connectivity, and it shouldn't work, right? I mean, that's the point. You shouldn't be able to get from the internet to the cell signal on the Jeep into the entertainment system and then flip unsigned software into that and then use it to pivot. But it seems like there are a lot of avenues that people haven't explored. And, I think the industry has, there have been folks working on this problem. And just like airline safety, if you want to get into that, there are a lot more conversations lately than there were a few weeks ago at a higher level. And I think that's a good thing. But we need more people with the critical mindset of trying to figure out how to break stuff.
One thing I'd wonder here is, what next for the patching of the cars? And this is why I was interested in asking you, with your experience, I think Jeep is actually mailing out USB keys to its customers for them to actually plug into the cars. Do you think we're going to see self-patching cars like we see self-patching operating systems in the future? Because logically, that's really the only place I can see it going.
So if I wanted to send some USB keys to Jeep owners and mine got there first with my software...
This is the thing. They're conditioning their users into an unsafe update procedure. So that's why I ask whether or not you think it'll actually wind up being an automated process in the future.
Yeah, click OK past the browser warning to install our software, right?
So do you think that's the way it's going to go? Or do you think it's going to – because 1.4 million cars going back to a dealer, you've worked in the industry. You know how much of a big deal that is.
That is painful, and it actually requires something to happen. You know, one of the things when you hear these numbers, a million cars recalled, a lot of times that's take a look and see if this bolt is rusty, and if it is, then you've got to do this thing, and if it's not, put a rubber cap on it, that sort of thing. And so a lot of the recalls are really extremely low interaction. They're check this, look for, look for connector. This one is no, pull it in and change the software.
Well, I mean, here is a clear market signal that they need to actually, it's going to cost them a lot of money to do this. So here is a clear signal that they need to be thinking about their updating. We'll just have to see how it plays out. Jack Daniel, thank you very much for your time.
You bet. It's always great to talk to you, Patrick.
That was Jack Daniel of Tenable Network Security there. Big thanks to him. And big thanks to Tenable for its support of the Risky Business Podcast. They buy 25% of this show's sponsorships, and they've done so for the last 8 years. So pretty much no Tenable, no Risky Business. So big, extra special, huge thanks to the guys and the gals over there. I also want to say a quick shout out to Virtual Office, my hosting provider. They're Sydney based, and Office is spelled OFFIS. Give them a call if you need some hosting that isn't EC2 based. As I say, they're based in Sydney. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by LabJacked. You've heard them before on the show, but not this track. This one is called La Policia. I only saw these guys a handful of times in Melbourne, but man, like, one gig was upstairs in the tiny band room of Bar Open on Brunswick Street back in the days when you could still smoke in bars and, people wouldn't just smoke tobacco up there. I didn't inhale, of course, because that's illegal. But what a great gig. I will never forget it. It was such a special show being in such a small venue and such a great band. As I say, this one is called La Policia. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Oh, and this one is filled with F-bombs, so mind the kids' ears if you care about that sort of thing. Bye!
oscura la noche en que la mierda pasó. Por un vacío en su estómago no vio que todo cambió. Mejor espérate ahí un rato, que la calle está lleno de Milico, Cuico y Paco. No pudo esperar, salió en la oscuridad. Suena la campana, tiene que empezar a trabajar. La calle fue donde lo agarraron, afuera del estadio su nombre ellos gritaron. Desapareció, nadie nunca más lo vio. Y esa noche su mundo se acabó. 35 años después todavía no olvidamos. Aquí nosotros quedamos, hablando de nuestro pasado. De la tierra que me llama y la tierra que yo amo. Por eso te vengo hablando de lo que nos pasó a nosotros en mi país, hermano.
Llegó la policía, madre mía, pobrecita no sabía
lo que pasó con su familia. Cuando llegaron carabineros y su gente desaparecían.
Llegó la policía, madre mía, pobrecita no sabía
lo que pasó con su familia. Cuando llegaron carabineros y su gente desaparecían.
Well, I'ma start fresh, thinking about the good times, the bad times. Never easy time in this hard life, the limelight, but a dark mind. My only pal is my pen, see, here's my heart, like what's left. Take it or leave it, I just don't need it, cause I seen it, been a fiend, and I beat it, so you can keep it, now I reap it. No more pain inside, I put my pride aside. I'm such a fucking fool, cause I could've lied. My eyes could never keep their cool. Now you're looking at me like an animal, so fuck off with a blood rule. Walk again, I begin to look into your mind, but I'm finding that you're nothing but a waste of time. 9 times out of 10, my rise be friendly, but I'ma definitely defend what's left of me. Jack's banging on my door, mama yelling flashbacks. Pigs are here, what for?
Llegó la policía, madre mía, pobrecita no sabía
lo que pasó con su familia. Cuando llegaron carabineros y su gente desaparecían.
Llegó la policía, madre mía, pobrecita no sabía
lo que pasó con su familia.